Our next case is case number 58740, Stephen Jacobs versus Sheldon Adelson et al. Mr. Morris representing the respondent, Mr. Vice representing the appellant. Again, for the record, as I mentioned previously, Chief Justice Chris Pickering will not, has recused from participation of this case and will not, excuse me. I forget, Mr. Jones, are you counsel of record as well in this case?
Yes, I am, actually.
Okay, I didn't notice that. I would have to recuse on this matter as well, and I didn't realize you were on this case as well.
I apologize. I'm wondering about that, but I know that Justice Perry typically recuses on all cases.
And maybe I might be mistaken on this. The issue about Sands and Sands China, for purposes of this appeal, they are not parties to this appeal. The only litigants in this case, on this appeal, are Mr. Jacobs and Mr. Adelson personally. So I didn't know that Mr. Jones was representing Mr. Adelson, so I don't.
I'm not. So actually, that's a good point. I'm here for the first argument, but I'm actually.
Okay, that makes sense. I was just concerned that if you were on this case, I would have to recuse as well, but I didn't see you on the service list or anything that would trigger my recusal, so I just wanted to make sure before I participated.
Technically, I don't have a dog in this fight.
Okay. Well, then I guess I'm going to stay.
Well, that resolved, then Justice Peregrine will participate in this case. Mr. Jones is not counsel for Mr. Adelson individually, then.
Just to make it clear.
Okay, thank you very much. Without it, Mr. Vice, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. As I indicated before, the matter before you is an appeal involving Stephen Jacobs and Mr. Adelson only. In Fink v. Ocean, this court made the following statement. Statements to someone who is not directly involved with the actual or anticipated judicial proceeding would be covered by the absolute privilege only if the recipient of the communication is significantly interested in the proceedings. I believe that that is, should be the start and the end of the analysis of this case. The question before you in this case is whether or not a public relations statement to the media, which was designed to attack and we maintain smear Mr. Adelson's opponent in litigation, is made to someone that is significantly interested in the proceedings when it is issued to the Wall Street Journal. This case stems from a March 15, 2011 email that Mr. Adelson used, or Mr. Adelson sent to the Wall Street Journal that said the following: while I have largely stayed silent in the matter to this point, the recycling of his allegations must be addressed. We have a substantial list of reasons why Steve Jacobs was fired for cause, and interestingly, he has not refuted a single one of them. Instead, he has attempted to explain his termination by using outright lies and fabrications which seem to have their origins in delusion. Mr. Adelson made that statement to the Wall Street Journal in response to a motion to dismiss that had been made by his companies, the Las Vegas Sands and Sands China, which had proved unsuccessful. They had sought to dismiss on procedural grounds, the procedural grounds being failure to what they claim remain an indispensable party and lack of personal jurisdiction over Sands China.
Mr. Morris, would it make a difference in our analysis if this is looked at as a conditional privilege opposed to an absolute privilege?
It will make a difference in your analysis, Justice Douglas, because the matter was decided on a motion to dismiss at the 12B stage. There was no affirmative defense even asserted at this point. The only defense and the sole basis for the disposition below is the absolute litigation privilege. So, yes, I would acknowledge that I do believe this court needs to reverse and send it back down. That will not preclude Mr. Addison from asserting a conditional privilege and litigating the factual questions surrounding limited privileges, which, as the court knows, are quite fact-intensive and turn upon a question of malice. We believe that we would overcome or we would be able to demonstrate actual malice in such circumstances, which would defeat any form of a qualified privilege. And that really, I think, comes, sort of takes us full circle to here. The litigation privilege, as this court knows well, is designed to protect the process. It's not designed to protect litigants. It's designed to protect the process. It's to encourage parties to be able to speak freely to the court and to the judicial process so as to be unimpeded in the search for the truth. That purpose is in no way served by a media campaign or a public relations campaign designed to attack one of your litigation opponents. In fact, I would submit that the court condoning that and saying that that sort of activity is privileged would go a long ways in actually undermining the legitimacy of the litigation process because, as the court can well imagine, that process would spiral quite quickly if litigants were allowed to take to the airwaves, especially wealthy litigants, were allowed to take to the airwaves and say, well, I'm in litigation, so let me now go on the attack against my opponent. That doesn't serve any interest in justice. That doesn't serve any interest that the judicial process has in resolving disputes. I would submit, as I said, quite the contrary. It does the opposite. That privilege, the litigation privilege, is reserved for those situations where the public interest is so vital and apparent that it mandates complete freedom of expression without regard to motives. Such statements to the news media are not worthy of any such protection from this court. There is, if that sort of activity were protected, then I guess Mr. Jacobs would be free to take out a full-page ad of the Wall Street Journal with Mr. Adelson's picture on it, as long as he cites the case and notes that there's litigation. He could recite any form of the allegations that he wants to about Mr. Adelson then and say, well, it's in the context that it concerns a lawsuit, so therefore it's absolutely privileged.
Well, we really have to really look at what society is today with 24/7 news and MSNBC versus Fox versus CNC. Yeah. I mean, to me, absolute privilege and conditional privilege is wonderful before we had 24/7. And now we have people on newscasts constantly. Sometimes we have to revise our thinking and our analytics in these cases to say what's happening. I mean, it happens every day, whether it be a criminal case or a civil case, whether it be rich people or poor people. Everybody gets their shot at 24/7 news.
And Justice Sherry, I actually agree with you on that, but I would argue that 24/7 news cycle counsels for very, very strict limitation on the use of the litigation privilege as the defense. Qualified privilege? Maybe. Right to reply? Yes, those are different issues that turn on the facts and the question of obviously actual malice. But the absolute privilege for litigation says we don't care about motives. Malice is actual falsehood, actual malice, actual intent to smear is an irrelevancy for absolute privilege. Because the process is so worthy of our protection, so as in the search for the truth in the courtroom, that we will immunize those statements, even if it turns out they were knowingly false and made for the purpose of harming your opponent. That cannot be the rationale for this court to say, news media statements to harm your opponent that are made with malice, where you affirmatively make a falsehood in order to harm them is worthy of a litigation privilege simply because there is a lawsuit pending. That completely would undermine, in my view, the legitimacy of the process, and it would, in my view, as I said, spiral out of control rather quickly. The public wouldn't have confidence, it wouldn't have greater confidence in its judicial process if we're going to have bickering between litigants in front of news cameras about who did what and when they did it, and name-calling as part of it, and then say, well, I can do all of that, and I'm now immune from suit because, hey, there's a lawsuit going on, and my statements concern the lawsuit. And that's why court after court has said these sorts of press releases, press spin, whatever you call it, are not entitled to the protections of the absolute privilege. Perhaps qualified privilege, which is a fact question, which is defeated by actual malice, or the response about reply, being able to reply to the charge that's made. Those are all perhaps legitimate defenses that would be available absent actual malice and a factual record upon which this matter could be determined. But here, the district court said, it doesn't matter whether he had actual malice. It doesn't matter. You assume that these statements are all false, and you assume that these statements were knowingly false and made for the purpose of harming your opponent. They were not made in the context of litigation. They were made as part of a public relations move by an opponent.
Mr. Vice, in the order Judge Gonzalez entered granting the motion to dismiss, she cited Circus Hotels versus Witherspoon and Clark County School District versus Virtual Education.
Right.
Tell me why you feel it was error to rely upon those cases.
Well, in the education case, just again, if you recall, the facts of that case were that the statement was made, it was a pre-litigation statement, and it was made to persons that had an interest in the litigation because there was a dispute that was brewing and it was going to quickly evolve into litigation, which it ultimately did. The question, that question here, no one is arguing about that there was litigation ongoing. But in that particular case, the person had an interest in receiving the information because they were ultimately, they had a stake in the outcome. That's the distinction. And if you look at Witherspoon, that's a statutory privilege in part there. And what the court is talking about, again, if you look at who was privileged, it was the fact is the recipient of the information that was privileged to receive it. And that is, of course, the big distinction here. Mr. Addison didn't make these statements to his board of directors. He didn't make these statements to anyone that has any interest in the outcome of this litigation. He made these statements to a neutral board with the very expectation and, frankly, the very hope that they would be widely disseminated and published so as to harm his opponent because a motion to dismiss on technical procedural grounds had been unsuccessful. And so he went on the offensive. This court, there's no basis in law for this court to say he's worthy of protection for going on that public relations offensive simply because he didn't get his way in front of the district court on a procedural motion.
So it wouldn't make any difference in your mind whether you had the case where you had a plaintiff taking a very salacious complaint, urging the media to pick it up and trying to get it published, the same result would happen in that case as well. The litigation privilege wouldn't apply.
Justice Breyer, I think that this court, and I would urge this court to think very carefully. I know that there are cases out there involving this issue, and I believe that Mr. Addison's counsel has cited a couple of them from Texas. There are all these cases that say if it is merely a republication of the document that is publicly filed with the court, then the litigation privilege still attaches to it. But first of all, I would...
Well, and I'm struggling there. You're taking, again, a very salacious complaint. You're offering it to the media for a wide distribution publication, and the absolute privilege applies, but yet, to come back on the other side in reply, you would have a conditional privilege and not a litigation privilege. Well, and I'm not sure that...
I would urge this court not to accept that premise that taking that salacious complaint and publishing it in the newspaper or affirmatively disseminating it to the media so as to get it widely published and disseminated, how does that promote the judicial process, which is the purpose of the privilege? If I have access to televised news, if I stand in front of a camera and I read the complaint into the camera and it's disseminated on TV, or today, as Justice Cherry pointing out, it's disseminated over the internet on YouTube, how is that consistent with protecting the integrity of the judicial process, which is what the litigation privilege is all about in the first place? It serves no purpose in that regard. And I would urge this court not to fall into the trap of saying any time something was repeated outside of the court that was repeated in the court is somehow absolutely privileged. If you want the absolute privilege, you say it in the courtroom. And if the media thinks that it's worthy of reporting, they'll report it. But you're trying to take affirmative steps of disseminating the salacious information or wild information so as to get it disseminated wildly isn't worthy of the court's protection, number one. Number two, in this particular case, these facts don't even fit that story in any event, because he wasn't disseminating information that was in a publicly filed document in the case. Again, their motion to dismiss, they had filed that answer. They had filed no counterclaim at this point in time. Their motion to dismiss was on a procedural ground. Two, one, failure to name what they claimed as a necessary party, and two, four, lack of personal jurisdiction over Sands China. When those procedural motions failed, Mr. Addison went on the offensive, and he made what my client maintains are demonstratively untruthful statements in an attempt to smear him, saying things like he had been fired for cause and that he hadn't rebutted any of it. Mr. Jacobs can assure you that's not true, and he is more than happy to prove it. Mr. Addison is the one asking you to please immunize him from the truth, because Mr. Jacobs is going to prove that those statements were untruthful and that they were made with actual malice by someone who was trying to smear him. Same for this I apologize.
I just want to say that you want to reserve some of your time.
I do. I apologize. I thought I
would give you 2 minutes, about a minute, and we'll give Mr. Morris 16 minutes.
I apologize.
Like that. Thank you. Mr. Morris.
Good morning again. Thank you for this opportunity to address you in this second case. I believe before we can make a decision on whether, or we should make a decision on whether this is subject to absolute privilege or conditional privilege and what the ramifications of it are, we should give credence to the context in that brings us here. Justice Sherry touched on it. Justice Perry touched on it. Let's remember who started this fight. And let's remember, if we're talking about the integrity of the litigation process and how it is we go about presenting claims in court that we would like adjudicated without controversy or unnecessary comment, let's talk about Rule 8A. This lawsuit that was initiated by Mr. Jacobs is a breach of contract lawsuit. He claims he was discharged without cause for the purpose of depriving him of a stock option. What's wrong with saying that in a pleading? Why, as it was in this case, necessary for the plaintiff, who's media savvy too, what is it necessary for him to say in advancing a breach of contract claim? Mr. Adelson is mercurial. He's obstreperous. He is criminal. Because he wanted me to engage in criminal conduct with him, and I declined. Why is that necessary? We find that in this complaint. And we put that out in our papers. There are 8, 16, 17 paragraphs in this First Amendment complaint, which hit the press the moment it was filed. 17 paragraphs in that complaint that have nothing to do with whether a contract was breached or not, but whether the person that Mr. Jacobs says was responsible for it is a thug and a criminal and a bully, mercurial personality, somebody who shoves people around as the consequence of great bullying with them. That's the context in which this occurs. When this complaint was filed, and those allegations were disseminated worldwide, and the lead disseminator was the Wall Street Journal. the financial publication, the corporate publication that everyone reads, who is concerned with corporate affairs and the economy, and deals by corporations with each other and with the public. That's where these allegations went. Don't tell me that the plaintiff's counsel and the plaintiff didn't know that. Any of these allegations were going to be publicized, and they were worldwide. And what is it that Mr. Adelson said in response to that when these were first published?
Nothing. He remained silent.
There were then court proceedings with those allegations circulating and recirculating, and there was an appearance before Judge Gonzalez by Mr. Jacobs opposing the motion to dismiss. The hearing was televised. It was attended by media people, including the Wall Street Journal, the lead disseminator of the allegations made by Jacobs against Adelson in advancing his breach of contract suit against Sands China. Now, when that motion was turned down, the allegations that underlie it on the limit were circulated and recirculated and disseminated and re-disseminated worldwide. And it is in that context, with the media furor over these proceedings and Mr. Adelson allegedly being a criminal, that he issued this statement. And I suggest to you a fair reading of it is his statement of opinion, which in addition to invoking litigation privilege, has some meaning under the First Amendment. As you folks said, in Rubin versus Kerman. This is what he said. You've been read to it before, but you know sometimes the way in which something is presented makes a difference in how it is received. So what did Mr. Anderson say? He said, what I just told you. While I have largely stayed silent on the attempt on the matter to this point, the allegations must be addressed. What's the context in which you said that? Worldwide publicity that this mercurial obstreperous, this very aggressive bully, this criminal, one of his companies lost a motion to dismiss. And it is in that context, he said, this is a breach of contract suit. It's an unemployment contract. We have a substantial list of reasons why Steve Jacobs was fired for cause. He said it this way. In my opinion, we have a substantial list of reasons why Steve Jacobs was fired. And interestingly, in my opinion, he has not refuted a single one of them. Instead, in my opinion, he is attempting to explain his termination by using outright lies. My opinion is untruthful. And fabrications, in my opinion, he's fabricated.
You may have a point, Mr. Morris, but the court didn't dismiss the case on an opinion analysis. The court dismissed the case on absolute privilege.
Right. And that brings us,
that's quite a different argument.
It certainly raises the argument, but I point out, and I believe you were the author of the opinion, Clark County School District wasn't Bessie, that the privilege is broad. You cited Fink versus Oceans.
The absolute privilege.
Pardon me?
The absolute privilege.
Yes. And you also added to that, I'm not trying to dispute what you said, I'm just trying to point out the context in which we are arguing this appeal. You also pointed out that any doubt, is resolved in favor of privilege. You did not say If I'm talking about privilege only in the context of pre-litigation statements, as Mr. Bice suggested, you did not say that Witherspoon was a statutory case that cannot be extended beyond those bounds. And you didn't say that Sahara Gaming Corporation versus the Culinary, which also said that the absolute privilege is broad and should be construed in favor of application, was not well decided or precedent to what you said. Look, the people we're talking about here with respect to recipients, the recipients of these statements are the same people that Jacobs was addressing, the consumers of news, people who are interested in what goes on in the corporate world, among officers, affiliates, subsidiaries, outsiders, the people who read the Wall Street Journal and make judgments.
How does that get us to an aspect of this test regarding someone significantly interested in the proceedings, either as a member of the media or, as you've just indicated, a member of the public that reads the Wall Street Journal is interested in a different aspect?
Well, how do you determine that?
Yeah.
One way you determine it is, I believe, by acknowledging what you did in Fortish when you decided the Anzalone case. And remember, Anzalone was a conditional privilege case, and it didn't require an evidentiary hearing. It didn't require a trial to decide. You decided that on the papers, just as you could do the same here. You could decide this in my judgment. I'm the advocate, so I give you that qualification. You could decide this case in the court of this dismissal on either of two grounds, absolute privilege or conditional. But I want to point out, when you said, how do you determine that? You look to what Justice Sherry said. We are in a different world now than we were when I was starting, when I was a young man and coming along, and other men and women were practicing law. We are on, and our clients are on 24-7, as you pointed out. Everything we say and do is reported by the media in one form or many forms: television, print, blogging, Twitter, Facebook. That defines, if you will, the audience, and that's what Fortich was talking about in the Anzalone case.
Let me ask you a question. You mentioned an interesting point a minute ago. Let's say the court concluded that the doctrine of conditional privilege applies as opposed to absolute privilege. The court granted a motion to dismiss here. How could we affirm at this stage of the case on conditional privilege when the facts haven't been developed? You said that you're firm on conditional privilege. How could you explain to me how we could do it? Because aren't there facts that have to be delved into?
Well, remember this. I started this one. I didn't mean to be patronizing. As you recall, but when I started this argument, I said, and I went through for a few minutes, what we're dealing with, I believe, is an expression of opinion uttered in the course of very contentious and personal litigation.
And Mr. Morris asked to that particular statement, what if instead of opinion it was viewed as a factual statement? What if Mr. Anderson's comment was viewed as a factual statement versus just merely opinion?
All right. If it's viewed as a factual statement, I suggest to you, you can affirm under absolute privilege, but if you disagree with that, say conditional privilege, then I would point to you, I would point to Anzalone. And I would point to the language in that case that this court used in affirming the dismissal of his defamation claim on conditional privilege grounds. Decided Fortich. Fortich held, among other things, that if what the person
motion in Anzalone was treated as a motion for summary judgment, Mr. Morse.
Pardon me?
The motion in Anzalone was treated as a motion for summary judgment. It was not a motion to dismiss.
True.
All right.
But you could, I suggest, you could do the same thing. You could affirm this on an alternative ground on the condition of privilege. If the fact that if the result was correct and the judge cited the wrong reason, but there's a sound reason available for it, remember we argued and presented to her the Anzalone case.
And she did reflect her decision in Anzalone on page 3 in the footnotes, so
yes.
She did discuss that in order. So you say it's squared up for us to analyze it under Anzalone and whether or not we feel that's applicable.
Now remember in Anzalone, you were dealing with, according to the characterization of this court, you were dealing with a statement which reflects negatively on the plaintiff's character.
What?
Take that, Mr. Anderson, as reflecting made a statement that reflects negatively on Mr. Jacob's character.
Mm-hmm.
His professional integrity. His honesty.
Mm-hmm.
In context. That's a statement of opinion, and under Anzalone, and under Fortune, she would not be. Fortune said if the allegations are widespread, the response can be widespread. But nonetheless, this statement of opinion is not actionable. Now, in addition to not being actionable because it's a statement of opinion, it may have some fact elements to it also, but they don't rise to the level. The statement doesn't rise to the level. You can't say from the face of it. And many courts have said likewise. This shows malice on its face. Look at Mast versus Dolberton. We cited that on our case. Where there was an exchange between two people, and one said of the other, who's suing for liable?
Mm-hmm.
You're a barefaced liar. That's about as stark as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Although Mr. Adelson had to deal with Mr. Jacobs accusing him of being a criminal.
Right now. May I ask one more question? Mr. Bice indicated while we're on this point that if we were to analyze this under conditional privilege, then malice may become a factor in this, that tempers the malice. That he said malice would diminish that privilege somewhat. And is that something that would cause us to be remanded? But you're saying we could decide this issue as a matter of law and not send it back.
I'm saying you can decide it as a matter of law, whether it's by absolute privilege or conditional privilege. I'm saying look at what he said. I'm giving you my opinion of Mr. Jacobs and his allegations, and I ask you to consider, among other cases, we've cited Mast versus Overton, we've cited some others, but one in particular that comes from this court, not another court, passing on statements like this, and that is Lubin versus Kind. And you said a statement of opinion is protected by the First Amendment, and it's not actionable. And that's what we have here.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Bice, you have, what was 2 minutes?
Thank you.
Okay.
Let me comment. Mr. Morris just invoked Lubin, and what Lubin actually, if the court might recall, says is that if the statement is capable of being one of fact or opinion, it's up to the jury to decide whether or not it was such a statement of fact or whether of opinion, whether or not it was actionable. Mr. Addison is doing a lot of arguing about there are alternate grounds upon which to defend the district court's decision, but the district court's decision is one that turns upon the question of absolute privilege. And I think that even the arguments that are being made, I think, demonstrate to you just how quickly this process, the litigation process, was spiraled away from being a search for the truth in the court of law, as it will become a quick media bickering contest and back and forth, that this court were to somehow say that the litigation privilege, the absolute privilege, which says malice doesn't matter, is immune from litigation outside of the courthouse. And that is, you know, my colleague indicated, well, this is just a breach of contract. So that's not true. Actually, what this complaint is about, the one of the principal causes of action is that this was a tortious discharge case in an attempt to cover up corporate wrongdoing and other improprieties that were occurring in Macau. And those allegations are in the complaint. And they're in there for a good reason, because Mr. Jacobs maintains that that's absolutely what happened. And if he can ever get this case to trial, he intends to prove that that's absolutely what happened. I'm not saying Mr. Addison wasn't entitled to reply. He is. He can reply. His companies could reply in the courtroom if they want the protections of the absolute privilege. But if you're going to step outside of the court and you're going to engage in a media campaign, a media spin, then you better be prepared to prove the truth of what you're saying. And malice absolutely defeats that claim. And in fact, it would be alleged right in the complaint that he did it with malice, which negates any qualified privilege.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Chief. What about Mr. Allison's statement is factually defamatory, Mr. Bice?
What about it is factually defamatory?
Yes, sir.
The statements, the following statements are factually defamatory. We have a substantial list of reasons why Steve Jacobs was fired for cause. That is, that Mr. Jacobs maintains that that is untrue, and he's going to show, and he intends to prove, that that was fabricated by Mr. Addison after the fact. We go on to say, interestingly, Mr. Jacobs, has not refuted a single one of them. Mr. Jacobs will prove that that is also completely an untrue statement made by Mr. Addison. He goes on to say, in attempting to explain his termination by using outright lies and fabrications, Mr. Jacobs intends to prove that the charge of lies is an untruthful statement by Mr. Addison, and that the charge of fabrications is an untruthful statement by Mr. Addison. He also goes on to say, which seem to have their origins in delusion, Mr. Jacobs intends to prove that he is not the one who is suffering from delusions. That perhaps someone is, but it's not him. And those are all untruthful statements that he is entitled to have the jury assess and conclude who is it in this case that is telling the truth.
Was the district court in this case asked to assess opinion versus fact on the statements at issue?
You know, Justice Arce, I should be able to give you a straight answer to that question, but I'm going to have to acknowledge I can't. I don't recall, as I'm standing in front of you, whether or not that issue was thoroughly briefed. I don't recall it being, but I don't want to represent to you that I don't, that it wasn't, because I just can't remember, and I'm embarrassed about that. I apologize.
Okay. Again, thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs, and the case will stand submitted.